As the new year approaches each December, The Economist magazine publishes their predictions for the year ahead. We all know that Donald Trump is about to begin his second year as president. We all know the Winter Olympics are about to take place in South Korea, even though Russia won't be there. And in November, the U.S. is going to hold midterm elections. But what are we not anticipating? Daniel Franklin is executive editor of The Economist and editor of the magazine's special edition, The Year in 2018. He is here to tell us what 2018 might bring. Hey, so thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Hello.
So let's start here. How has 2017 turned out?
Well, clearly it's been a pretty exciting year for anybody interested in politics, sometimes too exciting. From where I sit anyway, twin stories really here in America. Of course, it's been Donald Trump dominating everything, but in London, very much our Brexit saga, which sucks up all the political oxygen there.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, one or two things happening elsewhere in the world as well.
Just a couple. I mean, how does this jibe with the predictions you made?
We came out last year with our edition just 2 days after the election. So we knew Donald Trump was going to be president, and there was some rather intense adjustment to what the world under Donald Trump might look like. What we did not expect, we predicted that Theresa May in Britain would be too cautious to hold a general election, to call a snap general election. But in fact, she ignored that, and she did call one, and she probably regrets that she did, because of course it was a disaster for her.
Yeah. The magazine's been publishing this series for over 30 years. How do you make these long-run predictions?
Well, you ask smart people who know about stuff, particularly, you know, their area of expertise, to stick their neck out and say what they think is going to happen. And that's partly my colleagues at The Economist, but it's also outsiders. So we invite, unusually for The Economist, which is typically anonymous and written by our staff journalists and correspondents around the world, we open it up to some interesting people who are actually shaping what might happen in the year ahead. But of course, it's going to be, you're going to get some things wrong. It's a best guess at this stage, and things change. We went to press actually just before Robert Mugabe was thrown out in Zimbabwe. So it just shows you how fast things can change.
Yeah. I mean, what's the track record over the years? Is there anything that's been particularly interesting to look at?
Well, I think the track record has not been bad on certain things. You know, we haven't been bad on elections. We're typically in a typical year. You get probably the economy more or less right. But then the things that you may miss are the big disruptions. And
yeah.
Each year I go through the humbling exercise of looking at what we got right and what we got wrong. So in the world in 2009, I looked back at what we'd said the year before, and my article was entitled About 2008, Sorry, because we had missed the global economic crisis, so we hadn't predicted that. And so, yeah, you're going to get some things wrong. But I think readers are forgiving on that. They want a stimulating look at analysis and a sense of, as you said, some of the schedule things that you know are going to happen, and then opinions on the other events and other trends. And people know the world is inherently unpredictable, so many variables.
Yeah, it's more just interesting what surprises us, like what sneaks up on us, what doesn't.
Yes, and of course, natural disasters you can never predict.
You know, we started this show talking to Jaron Lanier, and I think that's really interesting because part of what Zanny Minton Beddoes writes about in this issue is this tech lash, is what she calls it. How she thinks in 2018 there's going to be a big backlash against the Googles and the Facebooks. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I think for a number of reasons it's happening, not just in America, actually, but in Europe as well, a concern about, on a number of levels, concern about just the sheer power of some of these firms that have accumulated huge numbers of customers and scoop up vast amounts of data. So the one concern is how they use those data, all the information they're collecting on us. And then there's issues such as, do they pay their fair amount of taxes. There's been some legal trouble over that in Europe, for example. And then the use of the platforms that they've created for things that they don't particularly want, but that they are starting to have to take responsibility for, the last presidential election here being the obvious example. So for all these reasons, I think these companies are in the political crosshairs. There's a new data privacy law coming into force in Europe next year, which is actually going to be affecting companies, not just in Europe, but any company that holds data on Europe, on your customers in Europe. I think that's just one example of the sort of thing we're going to see. I think we're going to see some antitrust moves against some of these big tech companies, some scrutiny of the mergers and the acquisitions that they put in place to try to make sure that they stay really without rivals.
You know, in the same essay, Zanny Minton-Beddoes talks about how this tech lash is part of what's giving rise to populist movements in Europe and the US. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, well, a lot of that has to do also with the rise in inequality. And I think technology is one thing that's driving that, that it is tending to deliver a lot of the gains of this surge in economic activity to a relatively small share of the population, and there's a reaction against that. And she, I think it's very interesting, she draws the analogy with what happened after the Gilded Age in America, where, you know, another period where there was very rapid change, very great wealth accumulation, and then a backlash against that. And you had the progressive era. And what you're seeing, I think, now is various ways in which the trends that we now have of accumulation of wealth are being challenged. One example is populism that can bring to power Donald Trump in America. Another is Emmanuel Macron in France, very different sort of view of the world, much more open view, but also seeking to protect those who are left behind in the era of tech change and globalization.
Yeah, she calls it Macronism.
Macronisme.
What is that?
Macronisme.
Oh. Got it. But do the accent. So tell me about what that is.
Well, I think it is a in contrast to a rather sort of protectionist, inward-looking view, which is Trumpism, America first. Macronism is a much more open international view of the world, but still with elements of protecting those who are left behind. And in Macron's case, he takes quite a pan-European view of his destiny. I think reform France first, and then build Europe, but very much participating in things that America has now said it's going to pull out of, such as the Paris Climate Change Agreement. So it's an interesting sort of juxtaposition of Trump on the one hand, one response to this difficult world we're in, and Macronisme on the other hand. We'll see how that pans out. But Macron is a fascinating character, I think, and his election was every bit as much of a surprise, if not more so, as Donald Trump's in America. And he faces a lot of difficulties in reforming France, but it's a really interesting experiment to watch in 2018.
Yeah, and I feel like here we're seeing all kinds of populist movements, including the Me Too movement. I wonder how you considered those issues since the Harvey Weinstein news broke when you wrote this.
Yeah, well, the spread of these things happens incredibly fast. It's not something we've particularly looked at in this edition, but it's certainly sweeping through politics here, and politics in Britain as well, and business as well. It's sort of rewriting the rule book, I think.
You know, John McCain writes an essay in here about the liberal world order. Can you explain what that was?
He was one of the very interesting people who are actually have a chance of shaping the world to give their view on 2018. And I think in his case, he is not a well man, as we know. He has a battle with cancer. So this was a particularly poignant piece, I think, saying the world that he helped to build, his generation helped to build, is something that really is worth defending, and it's not to be taken for granted, especially now. And it's in a way a plea to stand up and fight for it. That it really is the rules-based international liberal world order is something that is to be cherished. And can be defended.
Yeah, I want to talk about China a little bit too, because I'm wondering how it fits into the world picture, and whether what we're seeing with China is similar to what we saw with the rise of the U.S. when it became a global power.
I think you very much feel that with China, that it's a historical rise. It's been extraordinarily successful economically, but it is a giant country, a giant economy that is flexing its muscles increasingly and feels a growing confidence about doing that. And I think you feel that on several fronts as America tends to retreat from its global role in certain areas, such as on the environment. China is very quick to step in. It sees an opportunity there. And starting very much in its region around Asia, you feel the influence of China, where in many cases its neighbors or its countries in the Asian regions, it's their biggest trading partner, so it has growing influence. And you take a Western ally such as Australia, it feels very much the push and pull of China being a very important market for its raw materials, America being its traditional strategic ally, and trying to juggle those two, and the balance of power is starting to shift.
Well, it's funny to me because it seems like on the world stage, because The Economist, of course, deals with the world, not just the United States, we have China operating as a state, and then we have from America, not necessarily America in this moment, but so many companies, your Googles and your Apples and things like that, operating as international players. It's just a really interesting dichotomy.
Yes, but you also have increasingly Chinese companies that are going to be moving abroad. And that's, I think, one of the trends that we'll see more of. You know, we think of our big Western tech giants, but there are also very powerful Chinese tech giants such as Alibaba and Tencent, and companies that people haven't yet heard of particularly here but will do, such as the JD.com, which is the Chinese Amazon. These companies are growing very, very fast because of the scale of China's own economy. They're able to innovate quite quickly and grow at speeds that are quite mind-blowing. So we'll hear more of them.
Did you feel like with a year of Trump's presidency under your belt, you could make better predictions about what the next year would bring?
Well, I would hesitate to say that you can necessarily easily predict what's going to be tweeted at 5 o'clock in the morning, which can suddenly change the whole conversation for not just the day, but beyond. So I think it is one of the words that I think you most use to describe the Trump presidency is unpredictable. It's very hard to predict what's going to happen next. So in a sense, one gets more used to this style of governing the country, but it doesn't make it any easier to know what's up next.
Yeah. I mean, we're about to have midterm elections. President Trump only has a 38% approval rating. What did you predict for us?
For the midterm elections, it's going to be quite a tall order for the Democrats to take back control of the House. It needs a big, as you well know, a big swing to them. But our Washington correspondent who writes on that, he thinks that they will do it. And I must say, I think that has a certain force to it. I was in Washington at the time.
Forced, like it's forced, or
no,
you
I think it'll
happen?
I think when the pendulum swings in American politics, it tends to swing harder than people perhaps expect it to, and the normal parameters don't necessarily apply. I was in Washington at the time of, in 1994, at the time of the Republican revolution, as it was called under Newt Gingrich, when they took back control of the House after many, many years, and nobody really expected them to win so strongly. And I think something similar could happen in the opposite direction here, where you really get a strong reaction against the Republicans and Donald Trump.
What did you predict about these GOP tax cuts and what will happen next there?
Well, that they would get tax cuts through it, and it does look as if that's going to happen. I think there's in all this, there's a distinction between what happens in the short term and what happens in the longer term. And in the short term, the markets like it and the economy is on something of a roll. And in fact, the global economy is doing quite nicely. Most parts of the world are in a bit of an upswing. So that all bodes quite well for business. But in the longer term, there is the problem of the budget problems that it's liable to create. So it may just be building up problems for the future.
You know, we just had this big announcement about Israel yesterday. Benjamin Netanyahu is one of the people who writes in this issue. So I'm wondering how you put those pieces together.
Well, he writes mainly in this issue about the Israeli economy, not about the
right
issues of Jerusalem as the capital and so on. But intriguingly, he talks about, you know, the success of Israel as an innovation nation and as a high-tech powerhouse. He talks about how that has spillovers into politics, and his argument is that it's winning Israel friends and interest among its partners. But now this recognition, this move of Donald Trump's to recognize Jerusalem as the capital is going to, I think, create difficulties for whatever peace process there will be. Obviously, it's generated a lot of, the Israeli government is delighted, but other governments elsewhere are quite the reverse, rather perturbed by it, and it's already producing quite a stark reaction in the neighborhood.
I'm Mary Harris. I'm filling in today for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Daniel Franklin, the executive editor of The Economist's annual The World in Issue. And we are talking about his projections for the future in the latest issue, The World in 2018. We'll be right back after a break. My name is Mary Harris. I am back with Daniel Franklin of The Economist. I want to talk a little bit about North Korea and what you predicted there, because there's been so much saber rattling, and I just wonder what you see in the future.
Well, in the year ahead, I think we're going to get to the stage, very probably, where there is precious little ambiguity left in the idea that North Korea has a missile that would be capable of being nuclear armed and hitting the United States, and therefore the question confronts itself. And this is not something that is not the making of Donald Trump's making. This was an issue he has inherited, but it's perhaps the trickiest issue of all, and the most important issue of all. What do you then do about it? Is this something that America then has to live with and contain, or is it something that it has to take or decides to take some sort of action to prevent? And I think that's a really, really tough call. I think the danger of military confrontation ratchets up, and this is the sort of really nerve-wracking issue that hangs over the year ahead. I've talked about a relatively good economy and so on, but this puts everything else in the shade if it were to come to a really bad confrontation and potentially unimaginable numbers of lives at stake. So this is the really big one. And we get to the stage where the decision has to be taken. How do you deal with it? And I think what has happened in 2017 is that North Korea has just made much more progress, much faster than people thought that it was going to. And so the expectation is that it's really determined, on a course, moving very swiftly. What's America going to do about it?
And it sounds like it's the combination of a couple of things, where it's not just that conflict is hard to predict, but also you're finding that the Trump presidency is hard to predict. And so it leaves you concerned.
Well, the concern is that something happens almost by accident, that you get into a set of circumstances and a war of words that turns into something much worse. I think behind all that, the hope is that actually all players in this are ultimately rational. There are national self-interest that you can identify and see the reasons behind this sorts of behavior and why North Korea would want to see that its security and continued existence as a regime and a nation would be bolstered by having this powerful weapon. But nevertheless, it's not terribly reassuring when you see some of the rhetoric that's flown around this issue.
Yeah. Let's talk about the climate accord, because, of course, this is such a big year for that. And it's very hard to predict what happens next. But I wonder what you did.
Well, the meeting to look forward to in the year ahead is one in Poland, in Katowice, the so-called COP24. That's the follow-up to the Paris agreement where countries are supposed to have sort of put flesh on their commitments that they made in Paris. America has, of course, said it's coming out of the agreement. Other countries are determined to carry through. This is one area where China has actually said that it will stepped up and said it can continue to show leadership here. The Europeans very much feel the same. So the process carries on with or without America's support. The trouble is that even the Paris Agreement probably isn't enough to reach the targets that Paris says it wants to reach of no more than 2% warming over pre-industrial levels. And I think we're going to see increasing amounts of attention in the year ahead of other possible ways of dealing with that, of scientific solutions such as geoengineering. And there's a very interesting leader article by one of my colleagues saying that this is something that needs to be much more discussed, much more on the agenda now. It's tricky stuff, but it needs to be made explicit.
Well, it sounds kind of fantastic, this idea of re-engineering the Earth to protect the environment.
And there are going to be a couple of small but interesting experiments along that route.
Tell me about
those. In 2018. Very small scale, seeing if you can actually... the feasibility of doing this stuff. The trouble with it is that, first of all, doing it at scale may be tricky, and it also may have a lot of unintended consequences. So the more openly it is talked about, if it's going to be something that countries really want to embark on, really that discussion and those experiments need to start sooner rather than later.
I wonder... I just wonder, when I read this and when I look at what you've done over the last 30 years, whether you see anything in the pattern that where we will break through with something like climate change. It's very hard to see what's happening, and I think that makes it harder to act. I wonder if you know, from looking at previous years, what those breakthrough moments look like.
Well, I think there are certain breakthroughs that you do see happening in technology in particular. There are clearly, over these sorts of periods, there have been breakthrough moments politically as well, when the Berlin Wall came down, for example. So there are moments of really quite dramatic and striking change. I think on the climate front, one of the things that is happening very rapidly is the rise of renewables, and that's going to be a big factor in the years ahead. But it doesn't solve the problem of all the carbon that has been generated already and will continue to be generated as new economies grow very rapidly.
Yeah. I mean, you talked about what happened in London and the UK. What is the future of Brexit?
It's a big year in 2018 for Brexit. The actual time when Britain is scheduled to leave the European Union is in fact 2019, the spring of 2019. But in order to, if we are to have an agreement between Britain and its European partners that then has enough time to go through and be ratified by the European Parliament, by the British Parliament, that agreement really has to be reached by about the autumn of 2018. So we're entering the period of maximum pressure, maximum tensions in those negotiations, not just about the divorce settlement, which is what they've been talking about up to now, but also even the harder business of what the future relationship is between Britain and Europe after we've settled on the divorce.
And you have on The Economist website an article reporting that even Brexit supporters now expect a bad deal out of negotiations with the EU.
Well, there's a lot of debate over what a bad deal is, and some people say the hardest line Brexiteers say that no deal would be better than a bad deal. But actually, the trouble is that almost any deal is probably going to be on worse trading terms than we currently have in Britain with the European Union. So it's probably about degrees of badness rather than outright good deals or bad deals.
I wonder, as you put together this issue, you know, we're in the United States and we're in this moment of looking inwards. How much did you think about the U.S., or did you think about the U.S. differently than you did in the previous years, where you felt like, well, maybe there's less to write about here because it's impacting the rest of us much less?
Well, I think it's a bit of both, because at the same time, there's an extreme fascination with what is happening in America, and certainly The Trump presidency is very much in the news and on people's minds. So what happens in America also, as you pointed out, you know, the American companies are very influential. The American culture continues to be extremely influential in terms of Hollywood and the broader spread of whatever ideas are doing the rounds in America at the moment. So I think there is, and will continue to be, a great interest and fascination with America, but also recognition that America isn't going to be the answer to everybody else's problems, and we have to look at the different dynamics, especially when it comes to parts of the world where traditionally America has led the way too.
So culturally important, but not necessarily politically important.
No, I think one shouldn't go overboard. Still very politically important. I mean, it's still the superpower. It still has immense military, political, and economic power. Just using it rather differently and in certain areas tending to retreat, which allows other players into the game in important ways.
You know, you mentioned North Korea. I wonder what the other hotspots are around the world internationally that we need to be looking towards.
Well, the Middle East is always potentially a hotspot. It's just got a little bit hotter. But very important developments are underway, for example, in Saudi Arabia. There's a young crown prince there who's not only trying to introduce some pretty ambitious economic reforms. In fact, next year is supposed to be the time when they're going to list, perhaps here in New York, part of Saudi Aramco. That'll be one of the biggest, if not the biggest, IPO ever. But is also having quite a battle against his internal enemies, or people he suspects of wanting to hold him back, and also regional struggle against Iran, and the war in Yemen is a terrible tragedy that will continue into 2018. So there's a lot to look out for in the Middle East. And then in Asia, elsewhere, I think just the rise of China is creating all sorts of ripples. It's not just the Korean nuclear brinkmanship that we have to keep an eye on. It's Chinese assertiveness in the South China Sea, for example, that also has a potential to create flashpoints and conflict.
You know, you mentioned you have people writing in this issue, all kinds of people. One of them is former Disney CEO Bob Iger.
Yeah.
And he talks about disruptive innovation.
Not yet former CEO.
I'm sorry. CEO Bob Iger.
You're ahead, maybe ahead of the news. There's been some speculation about it.
Tell me a little bit about what he says.
Well, he is talking about the way that technology is transforming his industry, as it is actually transforming pretty much every industry in fairly dramatic ways. And moving into streaming is going to be a very big thing for video and for entertainment generally, for television in the year ahead and beyond, and a much more direct relationship between the media companies and their consumers, and not surprisingly, perhaps he argues that a company like Disney is well placed to do that both through its content and through its technology.
But he talks about disruptive innovation. I mean, what does that mean to him?
Well, the technology that is disrupting the way that people consume entertainment in that particular case, consumers have much more choice now about where, when, and on what platform they decide to consume their films or their sports or their television. So this is a very, very fluid environment, and this is the sort of pattern that's repeating itself in industry after industry. The technology platforms are fundamentally changing the way that the business models of people that people have got used to for years and years work. So there's a lot of rethinking going on because of technology.
Right, because the future doesn't necessarily look like getting my content through a cable provider. It looks like getting it on my phone.
Increasingly mobile when you want it, and perhaps even much more tailored to your own tastes.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder, you mentioned being in Washington in 1994. And I wonder if we can just talk a little bit about the comparisons between now and then. Because, as you said, you feel like you're on the cusp of something big. Is this a particular a call back to that time? How do you sort of see, how do you see it as someone who's watched this over so many years?
Well, I think that was looking back then the start of quite a big change where politics began to get much more ruthlessly partisan. I mean, it's always been, of course, a battle, but much more out and out warfare between the parties. With no holds barred and no quarter given. I think that the middle ground and the scope for compromise has just diminished over time, and you see that in very extreme form now, and it's become much more marked. So you could see the beginnings of it then, but it's just grown and grown, I think, in the intervening years.
What's funny to me is you still see some of the same players, like Newt Gingrich was there then, he's there now, and it just seems like the seeds started then.
Some things don't change, but then others do, and of course, you know, Donald Trump was there then, but he's here now in a very different form.
Yeah. Daniel Franklin, thank you so much for joining us. He is with The Economist. Thank you.